Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard Red Eye Radio Flight 790. Our captain has put on the fasten seatbelt sign, which means it's time to bring your seatbacks and tray tables to the full upright and locked position. We know you have many radio stations to choose from, and we do so very much appreciate you choosing KABC this evening. Now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the flight.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in Car Bombay. Come on and fly with me, let's fly away.
Oh, we're flying. I'm Doug McIntyre, piloting Red Eye Radio Flight 790 right here at Talk Radio 790 KABC, and I'm really looking forward. This is, and I acknowledge going in, this is a spectacular self-indulgence because we all stand on the shoulders of giants, and when I was a little, newt of a kid, just bubbling up there back in New York, I didn't sleep, so I used to sneak the transistor radio under the pillow at night and troll around and get real excited if I got a stray radio signal from Kentucky or something like that. And one night, I heard this voice in the night, this incredible voice that for some reason hooked me. And I didn't dare turn the light on because my parents would bust me. So what I did was, I shut the radio off when I was ready to actually go to sleep, and I carefully slid it out from under the pillow and I hid it under the bed so that it would be on the same station the next night to see if I could find it again. Eventually, I learned the station was WOR in New York, and the voice was Gene Shepherd, J-E-A-N, the French spelling Shepherd. And I was hooked. And it changed everything I've done the rest of my life. I wanted to be Gene Shepherd. Most of you know him from A Christmas Story, a movie that plays every holiday season. That movie is narrated by Gene. That's his voice. He's actually even in one little scene. And it's all based on his radio fiction and his published short stories. For 20 years on WOR, he did a nightly radio broadcast from 10:15 to 11 o'clock at night where he only told stories. He didn't take phone calls. He didn't play records. Or if he played music, it was usually rotten music, and it was underscoring a story he was telling. It was freshly made fiction of the highest order, storytelling of the best kind, and his programs always began this way. The Bonfreen Polka by Edvard Strauss, which was for many years the theme song to Gene Shepherd. Gene's life has finally been recorded. His work has been celebrated in a brand new book called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. And it's a pleasure to welcome to Red Eye Radio the author and a fellow Shephead, Eugene Bergman. Eugene, how are you?
I'm doing great, Doug.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. Now, for the purposes of clarity, since our subject matter is Gene Shepherd and your name is also Gene, we're going to call you Eugene.
Okay, fine.
Just to keep things clear. The book, it just came out. It's on Amazon.com. It's also just getting to the stores here on the West Coast. It's called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. Why that title?
Well, there are two kinds of reasons. One is the ideal and the other is the practical. The ideal is that Excelsior and Excelsior You Fathead is the quintessential Shepherd phrase. Excelsior in Latin means something to the effect of onward and upward, you know, to victory. And he believed in doing your best, but he also believed that if you were a little bit too idealistic and didn't have a bit of realism in you, you were a fool. So he was saying, you know, give it your all, but make sure you're not a fool, you fathead. So it's the ultimate perfect phrase to capture what the Shepard was about. In practical terms, anyone who knew Shepard, knew his work, would immediately grab onto a book with that title. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people who are not familiar with Shepard, but if they see a ridiculous-sounding title like Excelsior, You Fathead, in a bookstore, I'd like to think that they would have the curiosity to say to themselves, what does that mean, and pick up the book and find out what a great guy he was.
We're talking with Eugene Bergman. The book is called Excelsior, You Fathead, and it's published by Applause Books. And if you are a fan of Shepard's, well, you have to have it. I was in a bloodlust over the weekend trying to get, find a copy of this anywhere I possibly could, and devoured it. And if you're not familiar with the work of Gene Shepard, I'm hoping by the end of tonight's broadcast, you'll be curious enough to pick up a copy and read about this amazing artist's life, and also get the tapes and listen to him. Gene, one of the challenges, Eugene Bergman, that is, one of the challenges of writing about Gene Shepard, and I remember towards the end of the line for Frank Sinatra, somebody asked him how come he never wrote his autobiography, and he said, because you can't sing in a book. And he understood that the quality of his voice was his single greatest attribute, and it doesn't translate into print. The same could be said for Gene Shepard. His voice was, in my opinion, the single most seductive, inclusive voice ever broadcast on the public airwaves.
Well, I agree. And obviously, you can't get his voice literally in a book, but I've got a lot of transcriptions of his broadcasts, and I would hope that I capture a good bit of what he was like on the air. And of course, there are hundreds and hundreds of tapes of his broadcasts available. It would be nice to think that people would read the book and go out and get some of those tapes and listen to him.
Well, I agree. In fact, we'll give out some websites in the course of the night where you can hear Gene Shepard and actually order tapes. And the reason I recommend it is because you do a superb job. Gene Shepard's ad-libbed, jazz-like, and we'll get into jazz later, improvisations of these stories do translate into print because he spoke in almost perfect paragraphs, which is remarkable. I do this for a living, and I'm in total awe to this day of how he was able to do that. But once you hear his inflection, and then you read what you've transcribed in Excelsior, Your Fathead, then all the music comes together. It's fabulous. We're going to step away for a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Gene Bergman, Eugene Bergman. The book is called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard. This is Red Eye Radio Flight 790 on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Society Jazz Band, The Bear Missed the Train. This is Red Eye Radio Flight 790 right here at Talk Radio 790 KBC. We're talking about the great Gene Shepard, J-E-A-N, Shepard. And the book is called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard. The author is Eugene Bergman. And Eugene, The Bear Missed the Train, and Now He's Walking. That rotten song was played countless times on Shepard's radio show. And, of course, it's The Bear Missed the Shane, which was a hit for the Andrews Sisters, a Sandy Kahn lyric. But Gene used to just improvise to these songs, and then the Smith Street Jazz Band recorded it.
Right. He would do his little improvisation not only over some of the music that he got a kick out of, he'd do it over commercials, which was quite amusing. And he was hilarious doing some of these things. His scatting and just playing around with the music and with commercials in general. And, of course, The Bear Missed the Train sort of captures so well the kind of silly mood that he would often project on the air.
Gene Shepherd was enormously influential, and he had the great tragedy of being a genius in a medium that had lost its cachet with the American public.
Yes, unfortunately, by the time he got to New York in the mid-50s and got on WOR, he had grown up with radio when it was the medium for the American public. But unfortunately, a couple of things happened. One is that television was coming on strong, and the old radio networks were kind of falling apart, and commercial interests were putting all the money into the new medium of television. And then another thing that happened was the beginnings of rock and roll. You know, when Elvis Presley came along in 55 and converted a lot of people to rock and roll, and so many people were listening to music, and they weren't listening to Gene Shepherd, the genius of talk on radio, as much as would be warranted.
Well, many have claimed that Gene Shepherd was the inventor of talk radio, and I quibble with that a little bit, because the kind of talk radio that we understand today and that I'm employed in is profoundly different than what Gene Shepherd did. Gene Shepherd, well, there was talk and it was radio, but it was his talk. It was one-way talk. It was decidedly one-way.
Right. It's interesting that that's absolutely correct. But it's interesting that there was something about the way he talked. He seemed to be telling you everything about himself, and it, his thoughts, his feelings, his autobiography, and doing it the same way that, say, somebody in a late-night bar in which you were having a conversation, or somebody in a dorm and you were just getting into really interesting subjects. And it seemed like a dialogue, but, of course, he was the only one talking.
And that, of course, was true of Gene not only when he was on the air, but in his private life, in social settings, in life in general. Gene was born talking. The joke in my family is that when I was born, I asked the doctor to slap me. And that appears to have been the case with Gene Shepherd as well. He was a non-stop talker. When he'd get off his airship to WR, he'd then go on the ham radio and talk all night on the radio somewhere else.
Right. He couldn't stop. I interviewed a number of people, such as Jules Pfeiffer, Helen G., the original owner of the Limelight, his general manager, Herb Saltzman, and they all tell me the same thing. In private life, you could not get him to stop talking. Barry Farber told me that one day a nephew of his came into the station, and Shepherd cornered him and gave him the equivalent of a 45-minute monologue.
Just in the hallways.
Right.
Now, one of the things that is so utterly impossible to explain to people who haven't quite heard Shepherd or don't know the mystique of this amazing voice in the night is that what he did, he created the impression that he was talking to you individually, singularly you. And I know that I felt this way. Now, when I was that little 10-year-old kid back in New York listening to Gene through my transistor radio, it was my secret. And my brother got let in on the secret because I'd laugh. And then he was wondering what I was laughing about. And then eventually I did get busted by my parents. They were wondering, what's going on in there? And then I begged them to listen. And they got hooked. And then one by one at school, I would mention his name and we'd find other accolades. We'd find other disciples. All of us felt that we were the only one in the world who was listening to Gene Shepherd. It turns out there were millions of people who were doing this.
There was one guy who wrote a little note to Gene Shepherd memorial message board in which he said that he was in Philadelphia and he heard that there was Shepherd was going to appear, I guess, at the university there. And he thought, oh, boy, I'm probably going to be the only one in the audience because who else... knows of Gene Shepherd out here in the wilds of Pennsylvania. And when he got there, the place was jam-packed, and he heard other people saying the same thing. Gee, I thought I was the only person who listened to Shepherd.
It's almost the most common expression. After Gene Shepherd died in 1999, I wrote a piece about him for the Writers Guild of America magazine, and told the story about how I thought I was the only one. And then I started reading the message boards on the Internet, and everybody had the exact same story. We all thought we were the only one.
Right. It was an amazing ability that he had to do that.
The book is called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. Now, most people who know Gene that know him for his work as the creative force behind A Christmas Story, which is, and I'm going to use a toxic word for Shepherd, a nostalgic look at growing up in the Midwest during the Depression. And in reality, Gene hated nostalgia, and he certainly didn't like sentimentality. And yet there was sentimentality in his work. At the same time, there was an incredibly cynical view of not only life, but of humanity. And that's why the subhead of Eugene Bergman's book is The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. And we're going to pick it up right there when we come back. I'm Doug McIntyre. This is Red Eye Radio, Flight 790, on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
What a divine aroma.
Rutabaga cheese?
Smells like pan blackened sardines to me.
Well, just again.
Let me introduce you to a dish that's mighty fine. You can speak it on the menu wherever gourmet dines. From breakfast, lunch to supper, it always hits the spot. Easy to prepare. Throw it in the pot. You cook it for an hour. You baste it with some gin. You serve it with potatoes. You're ready to begin. Your mama will enjoy it. The kitchen will cry for more. When the neighbors smell it cooking, they'll be taken down the door.
Boiled out, boiled out. We all want some boiled out.
This is Red Eye Radio Flight 790 on Talk Radio 790 KBC here in Los Angeles and all of Southern California. That hideous song, the Boiled Owl song, of course, is embraced by fans of Red Eye Radio. And Gene Shepherd never played the Boiled Owl song, but I feel like he would have had he ever gotten to hear it. The subject of tonight's symposium is The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. The book is called Excelsior, You Fathead, written by Eugene Bergman. Eugene, Gene Shepherd was an enigma. He created this tapestry of characters. His childhood, which was fictionalized, he was born and raised, he was born in East Chicago, raised in a town called Hammond, Indiana, which was a steel mill town and a pretty gritty place. But he fictionalized it into Homan, Indiana. And he had a cast of characters, Fleck and Schwartz and Zinsmeister. Well, Zinsmeister was in the army, but Zudok. And all of these people, Helen Weathers, all of these characters that we heard night after night after night in original fiction that were so real to us. Even if you grew up in Midtown Manhattan or you grew up in Florida or Hawaii, if you heard these stories, they were so universal, like all great art, that it felt like he was talking about your childhood.
Yes, and you know, once people began finding out that a lot of what he talked about in the stories was fiction, they kind of thought, well, maybe all of these people that he mentioned were fictional. Well, it turns out that most of these people, Fleck and so many of the others, were the real names of people that he went to school with and played with. Now, how much of the stories was fictional and how much was true is another issue, and the chances are that almost all of the stories were indeed fictional, but the people themselves were people with those real names.
Gene Shepherd had an ability to make us laugh and laugh profoundly at human foibles. He used wonderful words like feckless, the feckless activities of life. Yet, he really resented and resisted being called, purveyor of nostalgia, because he had a very cynical view of human existence, and I don't think anything incorporates that more perfectly than the fact that so many of these childhood stories involve his exploits at the Warren G. Harding School, a school named after, not even arguably, the worst president in the history of the United States. And it turns out he did go to the Warren G. Harding School. He didn't make that up.
Right. When I first heard him say the Warren G. Harding School, I just thought this was one more quirky, made-up name of Shepard's. But I was out there in Hammond in the fall, and there it was. The Warren G. Harding School, and I have photographs of it. It still is a real place, so that's really where he went.
Now, this jaundiced view of humanity that we've thrown into the mix here, you talk about the title of the book, Excelsior, You Fathead. This is the enigma of Gene Shepard's art. That at the same time that he was inspiring, and I really mean that, to just grab the brass ring of life and to go out there and experience everything, it's a perpetual theme in his work that go ahead and try for it, but you're not going to get it. Or if you do get it, it's fleeting.
Right, and as you say, the overall effect of what he had to say was a joy in life, but there was this very strong undercurrent, and you kind of wonder to what extent he recognized that was going to be the end result of his own life. That is, he strived for so much, he achieved so much, but yet he never quite achieved everything that he wanted. He wanted greater renown. He wanted more people to recognize, literally, what a genius he was.
Yeah, humility was not one of Gene's attributes.
No, he was a real narcissist. That was part of why he couldn't stop talking, no matter the situation. He talking mainly about himself. And in addition to the hundreds of stories he told, sometimes he would just on his program comment on the passing scene or a news article that he'd seen or something he heard about or a movie he'd seen, or he would just muse about life in general. It was all, this is me, this is Gene Shepard, and this is what I think, and darn it, what I think is the truth.
And you know something, for those of us who were hypnotized by him, he was right, because while it might be narcissism, in fact, there's no question it was narcissism, it might have even been megalomania, and we'll get into that later, but the point is, he did talk better than anybody else. In fact, there's a wonderful story about the many times he was fired by program directors, because in his early career in Cincinnati and Philadelphia, other places, he was supposed to be a disc jockey. He wouldn't play the records because he wanted to talk, and they'd fire him for not playing the records. And he finally said, I can talk better than any record. And he could. That's the thing. It's old Dizzy Dean's line. If you can do it, you ain't bragging.
Right. And as you say, he was fired a couple of times in Cincinnati, and then he was fired from WOR back in 56 also. His general manager said, you got to play more music. And he said, well, everybody plays music. People want to hear the human voice. And the story is that the manager said, you will play music tonight or you're out of here. So Shepard played not one little bit of music, and they cut him off the air. Well, eventually, of course, he got back on because there was such a protest from listeners and other people that they pleaded with him to come back on the air.
The number of people who listened to Shepard who were influenced by him is amazing. One of them is Patty Chayefsky, the great American writer, because Network, which won Academy Awards, is one of my favorite films, and there's that famous scene of Howard Beale yelling, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And he encourages his viewers to go to their windows and throw them open and shout, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. But Patty Chayefsky literally took that from Shepard, who did that in the early 1950s, or the mid-1950s.
Right, and Shepard called it hurling invectives. And that was one of his favorite bits back in the 50s, where he'd tell people to open their windows, put their radio, loudspeakers pointed outward on the windowsill, and then turn up the volume as high as it'll go. And then he would come out with some wild phrase to sort of disconcert the neighborhood.
And, of course, they were never obscene. In fact, the fact that he called it hurling invectives is typical Shepherd language. But it's also important that it was him hurling the invectives, not the... He wasn't asking his listeners to go to the window and shout, as Howard Beale did. He was the one. He wanted them to put the radio in the window, turn it up, and it would be his voice echoing off of the apartment buildings all across Manhattan in the middle of the night.
Right. Uh-huh.
Gene Shepherd also perpetrated what is arguably the greatest literary hoax of all time. And this is something that Gene believes strongly. And, you know, I spent 4 years hosting Red Eye Radio exclusively from midnight to 5 a.m., and I am convinced that there is a difference between the night people and the day people. And Gene Shepherd understood this and pulled a stunt to tweak the pomposity of the daytime people. He created a bestseller called I, Libertine, by Frederick R. Ewing, that made the bestseller list, and the book didn't exist. When we come back, we'll have Eugene Bergman tell the story of the greatest literary hoax ever. Gene's book is called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd, published by Applause. This is Red Eye Radio Flight 790 on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
The Valley's Talk Station, Talk Radio 790 KABC.
This is Red Eye Radio Flight 790 on Talk Radio 790 KBC. We're talking about one of America's great artists and a man who was seminally influential in my life, Gene Shepherd. The book is called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd, written by Eugene Bergman. And we're playing this Dixieland music. Gene Shepherd loved Dixieland music. Of course, it would always be accompanied either by Juice Harp or Kazoo, and sometimes just trumpet on his head or a nose flute. And we're going to get into that later on in the evening, because Shepherd's association with jazz is really, I didn't even realize how influential that part of his career had been on me until just recently. Shepherd actually recorded with Charlie Mingus and hosted concerts by Billie Holiday, but we'll talk about that later. Right now, we've got Eugene Bergman here to talk to us about what really is one of the most fascinating, hilarious literary hoaxes of all time perpetrated by Gene Shepherd, the I, Libertine fictional bestseller.
Right. Well, Shepherd, this is one of these stories that we know really happened, but no one has yet come up with the actual tape of the broadcast in which he perpetrated this hoax. But the outlines and most of the details are really well known. He claimed that he was looking for a book in a major bookstore in Manhattan that he knew existed, and the clerk said, "Well, it's not on my list. I guess it can't exist." And Shepherd was rather annoyed, and he suggested that his listeners go out and ask for a book that didn't exist. Owen and listeners called in book names and so on. They settled on I, Libertine.
I, comma, Libertine. And
yeah,
they created a fictional author named Frederick R. Ewing with a fictitious biography.
Right.
And the idea was, Gene understood, Shepherd that is, understood that the daytime people had their whole lives dictated to them by lists, the 10 must-see plays for the new Broadway season, the top 10 movies, the bestseller list of the New York Times. But he understood that the New York Times bestseller list was fraudulent because it was based upon phone calls to bookstores at random saying, "What's hot?" And usually the seller of the bookstores would tell them whatever was hot was the one they ordered 1,000 copies of that was sitting there like a lead balloon. So by having his listeners go into bookstores and ask for I, Libertine by Frederick R. Ewing, no bookstore could get it because it literally hadn't even been written. There was no such book. But when the New York Times people would start calling around, they'd say, "Well, what's hot?" And the booksellers would say, "Well, I'll tell you, I, Libertine is so hot I can't even get a copy of it." And the next thing you know, it shows up in the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah, well, he... He really with the help of his listeners, really pulled that one off. There were even airline pilots who were listening to him late at night as they were heading to Europe, and they took the hoax over to Europe. And somebody who worked for the Boston Legion of Decency, the story goes, as a joke, put it on the prescribed book list, and nobody caught the joke, and it got published. Now, that's the story.
So the book got banned in Boston by the League of Decency, and it didn't even exist. Now, to complete this amazing story, a Wall Street Journal reporter was a Shepard fan, so he knew what was going on, and eventually he outed the hoax. And Gene then, with the great sci-fi writer Theodore Sturgeon, wrote the book, and then it got published.
And this all happened within just a month or two. It's amazing. You think of a book taking years to get written and get a publisher and get printed and distributed. He perpetrated the hoax sometime in August, and by October, there it was in paperback and hardcover and selling like hotcakes.
By the way, I have a paperback copy of this, and I know that you had one from when its first publication that you met yeah. Shepard and signed it. And that book is highly collectible, and I know that when it shows up on eBay, there's fierce bidding wars for it.
Right.
Gene Shepard, in addition to that, even had an influence on the creation of A Boy Named Sue. You want to tell that story, Gene?
Yes. Back in the 50s and early 60s, Gene Shepard, playwright Herb Gardner, and cartoonist and poet Shel Silverstein were very close friends. Shel Silverstein was doing cartoons for Playboy, and during that period, Shepard would write liner notes and dedications to Silverstein, and Silverstein would write liner notes and dedications to Shepard. And one of the things that they were always kind of kidding around with each other, and one of the things that Silverstein did was he took the fact that Shepard would always complain that his name spelled J-E-A-N, people would think he was a woman. So Silverstein wrote the lyrics to A Boy Named Sue, kidding his best friend Gene Shepard.
Of course, that became a huge hit for Johnny Cash.
Right.
And this was further complicated because there's a country western singer named Gene Shepard who is a woman.
Right, and occasionally on eBay you'll see one of the country and western singers' pieces come up for sale. In fact, a recent item was listed as a promo record for the country and western singer. But when I saw the title of the cut, I contacted the seller and said, "Hey, would you please listen to this? Tell me, is it really a woman or is this humorous Gene Shepard?" Turned out it was Gene Shepard, and I managed to buy it.
We mentioned earlier, Eugene Bergman, that there are some superb websites dedicated to Gene Shepard, and we have to include them because they were great help to you in researching this book. One of them is Flick Lives, F-L-I-C-K, Lives, L-I-V-E-S.com, FlickLives.com, where there are tapes that you can listen to right through the computer, and it's a wonderful website, biographical, it's got all kinds of stuff. Eugene Bergman, we've come to the end of our first hour. We're going to ask you to stick around. We're going to do another hour, and in the second hour, I'm going to play you, in its entirety, a Gene Shepard story, because I think it's necessary to hear this voice, so it's all in context. The book is called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard, published by Applause Books. Don't go away. Another hour to go on Red Eye Radio Flight 790, Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Flight 790. Our captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign, which means it's time to bring your seat backs and tray tables to the full upright and locked position. We know you have many radio stations to choose from, and we do so very much appreciate you choosing KABC this evening. Now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the flight.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me.
Oh, we're flying. I'm Doug McIntyre, piloting Red Eye Radio Flight 790 right here at Talk Radio 790 KABC. And I'm wallowing in self-indulgence tonight because one of my ultimate heroes was a radio artist, and I use that in the truest sense of the word. He was a great artist. His name was Gene Shepherd, J-E-A-N, Shepherd. And there's a new book that's must-reading for Shepheads called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. It's fun saying it, isn't it? Yeah, I'm getting a smile from Dan. It's written by Eugene Bergman, published by Applause Books. You can get it at Amazon.com. It's in the bookstores here on the West Coast now. And most of us know Gene Shepherd from the movie A Christmas Story. You'll shoot your eye out, kid, and Santa Claus kicking little Ralphie Parker down the slide in the department store. But that's Gene Shepherd's voice in that movie, and the movie is his work. These are all stories he told on the radio. He published them in Playboy magazine. In fact, he won Playboy's Humor Award 4 times. Hefner was a big supporter of Gene Shepherd's fiction as a writer. But his métier, his true genius, was in radio, and he practiced the craft in a way that few others ever have. In fact, for Playboy, now that I think about it, Hefner sent Gene Shepherd to England, and he interviewed the Beatles in 1965, didn't he, Gene Bergman?
Yes, he did. And I asked Hefner when I got to interview him, how come you sent Shepherd? Shepherd was always really very anti-rock and roll. And Hefner said, well, you know, we would do that sometimes. We would send somebody who would seem to be just the opposite of the sort of mentality who would go for a certain thing. We thought we'd get an interesting reaction, and that's probably why we sent Gene to interview the Beatles.
And he did get an interesting reaction because I've read that interview and I've heard tapes of Shepherd talking about the Beatles, and he liked them personally, but he had the same cynical view that while he liked them personally, he looked at them as four businessmen.
Right. You know, he... I think he probably went over there with negative feelings, but it turned out that he found them rather pleasant fellows. He enjoyed their company.
Now, most Gene Shepherd stories would begin with, I was this kid, see? But in addition to the childhood stories, he told these incredible stories about being in the Army. He was in the United States Army during World War II. He was in the Signal Corps. And we loved the Army stories. We knew Lieutenant Sherry, we knew Company K, and we knew all of the guys who were in the Army with Shep. And the only way to put Shepherd's work into context for those not familiar with him is to hear him at work. What we'll do now is let's listen to a story of Gene Shepherd. We've got this in two parts, so it'll be sandwiched around the commercials, which is something Gene would never do. We'd always get the commercials out of the way up front, and then he'd have a half hour to just go in uninterrupted. But let's listen to Gene Shepherd from WOR. I think this story goes back to 1965. It's an Army story. Take it away, Mr. Shepherd.
How many of you have seen scenes of true uselessness? How many of you, and you're just walking around life, you know, going up and down 6th Avenue, scratching around and tramping, blowing your nose and hack-and-sack, changing a tire in Darien, you know, just flubbing along, you know, occasionally see a scene of stark, pristine uselessness, totally and completely. Men involved in a feckless activity and who know it. Of course, many of us in the entertainment world have had this feeling that we're involved in a feckless activity and we know it. There's not a feck to be had in this whole business. I'm beginning to suspect. And yet, have you noticed that almost everybody in his right mind today, in this day and age, wants to get into showbiz? Some form, some nature. He wants to identify with you. You know, you can get little home comic kits now, where you can turn yourself into a comic at home. You know, a little book of one-liners and kind of suggestions on how to costume yourself, whether you're the angry beat-type comic, you know, with the sweater and the vague beard. You can be that kind, or you can be the Henny Youngman with the stuffed shirt and the phony violin. Home comic kits. Everyone wants to, you know, everyone wants to somehow transcend this mortal sphere that we walk around and become sort of larger than life. And after all, that's what the theater is, you know. It's to take, people and kind of, you know, screw the tire pump into their foot somehow and pump them up, and then they become Richard III. Or maybe, you know, the funny thing, I wonder if Richard III would recognize himself if he came back and saw himself being played by Laurence Olivier. Just curious, you know, I have to bring that up, but I'm curious whether or not the Prince of Denmark, that hallowed, haggard prince who questioned it all, I wonder if he could recognize himself if he saw himself being done by Gielgud. I mean, the real thing, you know? These little subtle, little tiny wisps, little smoky things of desire in the air, want all of us somehow driving, urging to rise above this thing we are with the bad knee, you know, and the tooth that bothers you when the wind hits you at a certain angle, or you drink water that's a little too cold, or your eye waters and gets full of ashes on Sixth Avenue. You know, this is something that Richard III doesn't have to deal with, you know? You never see Hamlet in the middle of a soliloquy all of a sudden say, uh-oh, and he's looking around for the facilities. You never see this. He's not bothered by those same problems that all the rest of us are bothered by. Not a bit of it. And, of course, the modern, the little man of today, he has long since given up being a hero. So he buys heroic things. He buys things which somehow will encompass him and carry him into that great land beyond the barricades. The heroic thing now is probably the only, probably as close as any of us can get to heroes. Buy a heroic car. You know, a car that has a raging Mustang on the hood. Something, you know, this is, you know, you're a 97-pound weakling, and you're going to be a 97-pound weakling. And you're going to die a 97-pound weakling, but you can drive to your grave in a Mustang. A raging, roaring, blood-red Mustang. You know, they've even changed the names of the colors. You know, there was a time when colors in cars, when you went to buy a car, they called it something like geranium red, you know. Now, of course, it's gore red. Yeah, I'm serious, yeah. It's gore red all the way down. And these little brass rings that we're trying to grab, and here we are, you know, you grab one, grab another one, hope for the best. And you know, when a guy goes into the Army, this is going to be an Army story here, friends, he sees himself as part of a vast panoply of marching men, marching to deal with and dispose of the evil that lies on the earth like a scourge. And especially during wartime, you know, you go into the Army, and boy, you hear the sound of marching feet, clum, 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 L-A-B. Oh, no, that's another show. That's another show. I'll award you the brass fiddle with bronze oak leaf palm if you can tell me what show began that way. L-A-B-A. Oh, man. This is Warden E. Laws. That was another one, too. This man is dangerous. Keep an eye out for him. Contact your local authorities. He has an anchor tattooed on his right bicep and could well be armed. Boom, boom, boom. Well, that was another scene and another time. But I, you know, when you go into a thing like a vast enterprise, you always see yourself as somehow clinging to the yardarm. I'm sure that every one of us, if we think of ourselves as going west in the 1830s, you know, the Bonanza syndrome, or or the wagon train syndrome, we see ourselves somehow as one of the outrigger riders, one of the scouts, riding way out there, you know, and reporting back to the main train that the Indians are now in the hills and you're going to stand them off yourself. We see this. You never see yourself as the little short fat guy in the last wagon whose only job is to fix the horseshoes. And they don't even give you a gun to shoot. You don't see yourself in that scene. And yet, there were little fat guys who sat in the back window, back wagon there all the way under the barrels of flour and nails and stuff. And their job was to carve tent pegs. Or their job was just to sit and hold the back of the wagon down so it didn't bump so much in the front. That was about the end of it. Now throughout all of history, there have been these solitary marchers, which, of course, is most of us, the solitary marchers. I'm curious whether Wyatt Earp would recognize himself if he came across himself on a TV rerun late some night on Channel Whoopi, way, way late down there some night. I wonder if an L.A. cop would recognize himself if he saw himself played by Jack Webb on a fifth rerun on a late Channel Whoopi production, you know, way down there in the last days of Pompeii, slowly sinking in the west, played by Charlton Heston, Victor Mature. Susan Hayward, of course, has to show up with a bowl of fruit on her head and carrying John the Baptist's skull in one hand and a sword in the other. But this is all part of the this is all part of the scene. And when you go into something big, you know, I'm sure that every kid, a lot of guys, you say, I don't want to get killed. You know, they talk about how they're scared to go in the army. Son, you'd be very lucky if you got that close. All I got to say is about one guy out of a million in the army ever got close enough to get shot at. And behind that one guy, there were millions of guys doing feckless little jobs, sad, raggle-taggle jobs, very difficult to explain back home why they were there and how it happened. Well, I'm in a company one time, you want to hear about one of the saddest sights I ever saw in this great panoply of the war against tyranny and Hitler and all the rest of it. And I'm in this company, it's a Signal Corps company. Now, the Signal Corps encompasses all kinds of things. It encompasses movies, did you know that? The Signal Corps units are constantly making movies out in Long Island someplace. We just heard a rumor of that. What a great job that would be, you know, to somehow be assigned to a movie unit. That was like Never Never Land. And then there were guys that put up poles. There were other guys that strung wires for miles. There were guys that ran radar sets. And there were guys that operated keys, you know, Morse code keys. And there were guys who just sat in offices and took one paper off the pile to their left and put it on the pile to their right. And reached over and took another paper off the pile to their left and put it on the pile to their right. And once in a while, off in the distance, a bugle would blow, and he would get up stiffly and go to the mess hall and stuff his face and come back and start taking papers again, up to the top and down to the bottom, hour after hour. Well, this is not my story tonight. This is not the story of the company clerk, none at all. It's even, in a sense, a sadder one. I'm in this dynamic, modern, completely electronicized 20th century radar company. Now, you know, a radar company in those days... Oh, by the way, this is Gaunt Rockwell here. And this is your Whoopi station, WOR, AM and FM, New York. And would you please, if you will, operator, strike the money button there.
All right, the strike the money button was Gene Shepard always his signal that the commercials had to be played. That's what we'll do when we come back. We'll continue our conversation with Eugene Bergman, author of Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard. We're listening to Gene Shepard in the middle of one of his army stories, and we'll continue that and conversation with Eugene Bergman when Red Eye Radio continues on Talk Radio 790 KBC. Radio Flight 790 on Talk Radio 790 KBC. I'm Doug McIntyre. We're talking about one of the great American artists. His name is Gene Shepard. He was the undisputed master of radio, a fabulous writer, filmmaker. He was good at everything, but storytelling was what he did. Yeah, there's a new book about Gene out. In fact, it's the only book about Gene. It's called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard. Eugene Bergman is the author. Right now we're listening to Gene Shepard at work, the show from 1965, recorded from WOR in New York City. Let's go back to the storytelling art, an army story, Gene Shepard.
You know, you've got the picture now. This is a dynamic, modern outfit. We have big parabolic reflectors. You know what is it, a parabolic reflector? Oh, you've seen, of course, movies of space exploration. Have you noticed that almost every SF picture these days begins with a shot of a radar tower? You notice that, Matt? Almost every SF picture, and they have a radar tower. I don't know why radar is constantly involved in SF, but nevertheless, this old radar tower. And some of that radar, incidentally, I'll have to add as an addenda here, some of that radar that they show in the SF pictures goes back to the antediluvian days of radar. They must have got it on a surplus deal from a Civil War radar company. I'll tell you, it's really ancient stuff. I saw one the other day. It says dynamic 20th century, 28th century or something. They give you. You see this radar going. That was purely a museum piece. It was one of the first they used in the Battle of Britain. You know, back in the days when Winnie was a lad. And the radars go back and say, oh, wowie. Holy smokes. Well, nevertheless, though, I'm in this dynamic, hard-hitting radar company. We've got little special insignia with lightnings and all that stuff all over, some helmets with lightnings on the side. And boy, we're really a gung-ho radar outfit. We've got all the equipment set up there, and it's humming, and it's beautiful. You know, it's secret, too. Had a electrified fence around it. We're training. Everything is going. We're swinging by. We're the new dynamic electronic army, men of the future, science. All the rest of it, you know, space, flying aircraft, and the whole scene. We were on to IFF, and we had all kinds of little secret numbers. That nothing gives you a sense of really being part of the future. Then everything you talk about is just merely numbers, like IFF 697/ANJ, that kind of thing. That's the way we described our equipment. Well, we were swinging along there, and everything was, you know, just going hunky-dory. By the way, speaking of that, in the next barracks, right down the street from where we were, there was a very famous movie star. And I'm not going to tell you who he was, it doesn't make any difference. He was in the next barracks, and he had played in a whole succession of gigantic war epics. And he was always like a colonel, or he was always like, you know, a captain. He was being parachuted into Burma and all that stuff. And now suddenly he arrives, and he is a yardbird, raggle-taggle private. And he is two or three barracks down from us. And he cried day after day. He would just sit there and cry because he's in the army. And we'd see him in the PX crying. Oh, his agent is on the phone, and all the great deals. He's crying. He tried everything. I think he stuck ice picks into his ears and shot his M1 gun into his foot. He tried everything to get out. And sure enough, he made it. And about 7 months later, after he got out, we all marched down to the post theater to see his latest war epic, where he was a commando. He was a great commando. He had a helmet, you know, with mud all over the... Well, nevertheless, here we are. We've got this dynamic radar outfit. And we're men of the future. When suddenly, without any warning, there was a big company area next to us that was not occupied. Another outfit moved in next to us. And they had wagons, you know, they had big prime mover trucks. They had big, dark, green personnel carriers. Boy, what a mysterious-looking outfit this was. And these guys had field jackets with no insignia on them. And we kept going, wow, holy smokes, what is this? Some kind of an atom bomb outfit? A very secret outfit? But yet, they had sad looks. Every last one. They did not have the kind of sad look that guys get from just being in the Army, but really sad looks. Some kind of strange, mysterious sabbath, like they were doomed. Doomed men. And the whole company was sort of walking around quietly. They would sweep up and see guys picking up butts. And remember, we were in a restricted, kind of a restricted area where you couldn't just go in and, what are you guys doing? You know, nobody quite did that. And for days, the rumors floated around in our company what these guys were up to. Their full complement had not arrived, and then one day it arrived. A truck arrived with about nine guys riding before it in jeeps and guys coming by after it, but a truck. And funny noise it made when it went past our company area. The truck itself made a strange sound, sort of like, ooh, ooh, ooh. There was something in that truck alive. Alive. Get this. It was not a horse. It was not the things you associate with the army, you know. Just something alive in the truck. Big covered truck, and it had curtains on the side of it. They pulled into the company area next. We're all curiously watching. Here were dynamic looking guys with our lightnings on our hats. You know, our big radar set is searching the skies for hurtling aircraft. And these guys began to set up a whole row of pens. These sad, silent, lost men. And one by one out of the trucks, they took Signal Corps pigeons. It was a pigeon company. A pigeon company. Do you have any idea how lost and sad and woebegone a pigeon company is in the middle of electronic wars with single sideband radio equipment, with walkie-talkies, with all kinds of special long lines radio transmission stuff going and the radar going? Hey, these guys got these pigeons. Coo, coo. I'm not inventing it. Pigeons. And we couldn't believe it. You know, the rumor immediately, we got a pigeon company next to it. This was like something out of the, you know, it goes back to Florence Nightingale, you know, the War of the Roses. We couldn't, it's like if a company of knights arrived, you know, guys with maces, and they got helmets and big plumes on the top of their head, they arrived. You don't know what to make of this. They're pigeon company. What, where are they going to use pigeons? And that was the hooker. Nowhere. And these guys knew it. They were in a dead-end outfit. They were pigeon men. And, of course, they began to drift into the PX then. We knew that the jig was up. We thought, up to this point, you know, there was some kind of an atomic bomb outfit. They're pigeon guys. Pigeon guys. And here they are, living cheek by jowl with this 23rd century radar crowd. Completely in the future. In fact, so much so that hardly anybody in the place knew what the word radar meant in the whole camp. And here we were, dynamic, like missile men or something. And we'd go down to the old PX, and these guys would sit around. I remember one day sitting there talking to a corporal, and he's sitting across from me. We're both having a sandwich, and he's from the other outfit. I says, pigeon company, huh? He says, yep, pigeon. I'm in a pigeon company. He says, you know what I shovel all day long? Yes, indeed. I guess I do, fella. He says, well, he says, you know the old expression, chicken? The old army expression? I said, yeah. He says, we don't use it. We got another expression, you know. He says, we don't only have an expression. We got the real thing. It's all over there. It's every place there. Pigeon company. And so night after night, I would go into the pigeon company's area with other dynamic radar guys, and we would go up and down through the cages and look at the pigeons. You know, they had their special pigeons. Some pigeons were ace pigeons. There were like sergeant pigeons, and there were corporal pigeons. They had rank. They were private pigeons, and each one had a Signal Corps ASM number on his little foot. You know, his serial number. You know, like a pigeon number 14-1722D. And once in a while, there'd be big excitement. A pigeon would go AWOL. They would take them out, and they would fly. Yeah, they were always flying the pigeons around. Of course, we were always threatening to shoot them down. With our oh, yeah, it was one of those sad scenes. And we would watch these pigeons. They were going great, like flocks, I guess they call them. Up they would go, and all these guys would stand around, and they'd drive away. And whatever they did, they had maneuvers with the pigeons. I think they'd drive out into the boondocks and let the pigeons go, and then run back and wait for them to come back and cheer when they'd arrive, you know, and all that stuff. And then finally, one day, the word came, the pigeon company was getting shipped. They were alerted now. It's overseas time. and they were packing their little pigeons into their GI cages, and they were putting their little GI overcoats and their little canteens on, you know, and they were putting their little helmet liners and stuff on the pigeons. And all the pigeon men were walking around in their company area with that stunned look of guys who have got the orders, you know, they're going overseas now. And the one thing we could not figure out is where was a pigeon company getting sent? Where would you send a pigeon company? And not only that, they were on a hurry-up alert. There was some fantastic, desperate need for a pigeon company somewhere in the world. And these guys are running around, you know, getting their shots and all. Whoop, in the dead of night, this secret pigeon company took off in a great big airplane and were never seen or heard from again. I still don't know where that pigeon company went. Did they actually use their pigeons? Do you know that there are several Signal Corps pigeon heroes? One pigeon that was shot down in no man's land in World War I and hitchhiked all the way back with his message, ducking from shell hole to shell hole. Yeah, do you know what? There's a famous pigeon that is stuffed. And he is stuffed. I'm serious. He's got the Congressional Medal of Honor or something. I don't know. These guys were always talking about great pigeons of the past. Of course, they were involved in pigeons. And they were talking about great pigeons of the past, old Peg Leg Pete. They have names like that. And they have pictures of great pigeons and autographed pictures of pigeons. Sure, they were combat pigeons. Don't laugh. There were pigeons that were also on special detail, OSS pigeons. There were, I'm not exaggerating. Everyone laughs. But this pigeon company, to me, was one of those sad moments that I've seen in my lifetime of guys who were involved in something that was totally out of keeping with the time in which they lived. No guy getting drafted, I'm sure, from Indianapolis who sees himself going up the beach at Anzio or something could ever possibly conceive of himself with a little broom, you know, with a going around. How do you explain that back home? How do you tell the chicks at the USO I'm in the secret company? And, you know, there's a certain aroma about pigeons. There's a certain unmistakable aura that exists around pigeon troops. Well, these funny little holdovers, these backwaters, these backwashes of great historical movements are lost completely, usually, in the histories that are written about those times. I doubt whether there will ever be a combat TV episode about a pigeon company. Have they done that? Really? You mean pigeons in World War II? Where do they use them? Where? They did, on combat, they had a pigeon company, huh? I'll be darned. Well, I'm glad to hear these guys finally got overseas. Who got the strikes, though? Who got the DFCs and all? Do they give a pigeon a DFC? Does he get a Distinguished Flying Cross? What does he get? I mean, does a pigeon get flight pay? Does it's very difficult, but do you draft pigeons? Does a pigeon, is there a conscientious objector pigeon? I suppose the ones that took off were. I guess there are still some pigeons hiding in the boondocks out there. They won't come back. You know, they're waiting for the war to be over. You know, they're not
used. Well, that's a little taste of the art and craft of Gene Shepherd. He's the subject of tonight's Red Eye Radio broadcast. Eugene Bergman is the author of Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art Enigma of Gene Shepherd. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Eugene Bergman. This is Red Eye Radio Flight 790 on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Let me tell you about a place somewhere up in New York way where the people are so gay, twisting the night away.
Well, we're twisting the night away as I did many nights of my life to my feckless youth listening to Gene Shepherd. Eugene Bergman is the author of Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. It's published by Applause Books. You can get it at Amazon.com. It's now in the bookstores on the West Coast. And, Eugene, we played that story of Shepherd, and it's selected nearly at random, but as an example of the storytelling and the digressions, and we love the digressions. Gene would start telling a story and stray away from it. You figure, well, he's never going to find the ending, and he somehow always did.
Well, he was famous for digressing and then coming back quite often just as the last notes of his theme music were playing in the background, and all of a sudden he would get back to that the end of the story and wind it up just in time to say WOR AM and FM New York, and that was it. and the program was over.
Now, I want to touch briefly on this because in addition to, you know, my appreciation for Gene Shepherd, I'm a passionate fan of jazz, the American songbook. And Shepherd's association on the show, he played mostly rotten music, I mean really awful music. But he really loved jazz. In fact, he was a jazz artist, really, because that's what he did was improvise. And, you know, I didn't know this, but when I read your book, he actually hosted jazz concerts, including a concert with Billie Holiday in Greenwich Village.
Yeah, this was a concert at Lowe Sheridan. It has something like 2,500 seats at the time. And he was the host. The Village Voice was just struggling along, and he was writing for the Voice, and they thought they could get some good publicity by being associated with it. And he was the MC for the whole thing, and the big star of the evening was Billie Holiday. He also did a Central Park concert, jazz concert, in which he was the MC and Billie Holiday sang a couple of songs, and I attended that one because I heard him announcing it on one of his shows. But he was a gigantic jazz fan. He wrote for columns on jazz for Audio Magazine. He played much more deep and modern and serious jazz on his earlier programs. And he associated with most of the major jazz figures of the 50s, such as Charles Mingus, with whom he recorded. He did a whole album called Gene Shepherd Into the Unknown with jazz music, and he was really right in there with it. And he was admired because he was an improviser like a jazz musician.
In fact, I've got a cut of Shepherd's record, The Clown, with Charlie Mingus, which has been in print for many, many years. It's still available in record stores, and we'll play a little of that when we come back. It's basically Shepherd ad-libbing a story over Mingus's musical background, blending the humor and the observation of Shepherd with jazz rhythms. Eugene, the story of Gene Shepherd. None of us knew anything about him on a personal level. We listened to his stories, we read his books, we read his short stories, we read Car and Driver magazine. I had zero interest in Car and Driver magazine, but he wrote for it, so I bought it and read it. He had a bunch of series on television, Gene Shepherd's America, Shepherd's Pie, and others. Made movies, Phantom of the Open Hearts for PBS and others. Phantom of the Open Hearts, by the way, is a wonderful movie. A lot of which, that material ended up back in a feature film when A Christmas Story got made. But on a personal level, he kept his private life secret, and it was only after his passing that we started to get a picture of how ugly, in fact, and very sadly so, but how really ugly a lot of Gene's private life was. When we come back, maybe we can touch a little bit on the dark underbelly that creates to the enigma of Gene Shepherd. Eugene Bergman's our guest. The book is called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd. This is Red Eye Radio Flight 790 on Talk Radio 790 KVC. This is Red Eye Radio Flight 790 on Talk Radio 790 KABC. You're listening to Gene Shepherd with Charlie Mingus from The Clown.
Man, there was this clown. And he was a real happy guy, a real happy guy. He had all these greens and all these yellows and all these oranges bubbling around inside him. And he had just one thing he wanted in this world. He just wanted to make people laugh. That's all he wanted out of this world. He was a real happy guy.
We could easily be talking about Gene Shepherd there, too. Gene might very well, once again, have been talking about himself. Here was this clown, the real happy guy. He only wanted one thing out of life, to make people laugh. That's really professionally what Gene Shepherd did want, Eugene Bergman. But on the private side, it's his obsession with recognition, with laughter, with storytelling, with being acknowledged as a genius, which he was, really didn't leave much room for personal relationships.
rather avoided them when he could. And in the late 50s, in fact, he had a wife and two children, and he left them. And he had very little association with his kids from that time forward.
In fact, it was shocking when Gene Shepherd died in 1999, the obituary said there were no survivors. And then all of a sudden a letter shows up in the New York paper saying, oh, contraire, he has survivors because I'm a son. And he had a son and a daughter, Randall and Adrian Shepherd, that he literally denied that he even had them.
Yes, that of course was something that his children, I think, have never gotten over. I've talked to both of them, and it's obviously a very upsetting thing for them. And one interpretation of that is somehow he wanted to seem free and unfettered to his listeners, and somehow having a family, he seemed to feel undercut that a little bit, and he was somehow cold enough to let that dominate his thoughts, and it's really sad.
It's a replay also of what happened in his own life, because the old man, who was of course one of the great characters of his fiction, was based on his true father, who split from his home when he was a young boy and never returned.
Yes, and it's interesting that the TV producer-director Fred Barzyk, who did a lot of Shepherd's GBH work, said that he felt that was a really determining factor in Shepherd's psyche that made him, that damaged him so strongly. Now, I don't do too much psychoanalyzing in the book, but I do quote a few people to similar effect. And it was, it seemed to affect him maybe more than he wanted to admit. But he told somebody that, yes, he was his father's son.
Yeah, towards the end of his life, Gene became increasingly embittered. He was married successfully to Lee Brown, who started as his producer, who he was completely, utterly devoted to, and she died before he did, and then he disintegrated terribly, both physically and mentally, towards the end of his life. In fact, Alan Combs, Sean Hannity's partner on television, I believe, did the last interview with him, where Gene was denigrating his own work on radio, which was a shame, because that was, ultimately, his greatest art form.
Well, you know, I believe that...